Welcome to Sauce Secrets, a Vail of Wood podcast where we take you behind the bar and deep into the world of the Texas alcohol manufacturing industry. I'm your host, Clark Smith, a partner at Vail of Wood. Each episode, we sit down with a trailblazer behind Texas's favorite drinks to dive into their personal journeys, career-defining moves, and the key business decisions that set them apart. Whether you're an aspiring alcohol entrepreneur or just love a good business success story, you'll get insider knowledge on what it takes to thrive in this competitive industry right here in Texas. So pour yourself a glass and let's uncover the sauce secrets. Welcome to Sauce Secrets. I'm your host, Clark Smith from Vail of Wood. We're here with Jared Hempstead, head distiller at Balcones Distilling in Waco, Texas. Jared, we're super excited to meet with you today and hear about your background and your story and about Balcones and what you guys have going on. You say you're not from Waco, but you got here as quick as you could. Let's hear some of your background.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I feel like there could be a ton of background. I'll stick to stuff that's relevant to what I'm doing now. But I think some combo of just kind of being a hands-on kind of DIY oriented person to begin with. There's always been something really rich about getting your hands dirty and getting involved with something that your appreciation changes, you know, if you have some experience with it. People like to tinker with cars, or I did that with bikes, still do. Used to play in punk bands in college, and like nobody's going to book your show. So you rent a PA and do it in someone's backyard kind of thing, or the VA. So later, much later, got involved in homebrewing. Friend of mine was homebrewing and got me some equipment as a wedding gift, and pretty quickly got pretty enamored with that and was reading a lot and buying books and trying things out. And fast forward another 6-7 years from there, and single malts, especially old world single malts, it just really grabbed me. And in hindsight, I don't remember really even thinking about it too hard. It just seemed to make sense to try your hand at it and kind of fool around with it on your own and see what it's all about and learn when you pull different levers, what they do and how it affects the final product and stuff. Just made a lot of sense. So in some ways, I feel like I mostly was kind of just looking down at like the very next step every time. And
you ended up here.
Years later, looked up like, how did I get here? Because just kept walking, you know, one foot in front of the other.
Well, that's to me a fascinating aspect of your background, is that you were an alcohol manufacturer before you were a licensed alcohol manufacturer. You took pride in it and a lot of interest in it. I have to think that that gives you a unique, different perspective than a lot of your colleagues in the Texas alcohol manufacturing industry. I think you also, at one point, you worked retail and on-premise. Could you give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah. So I did social work, and I also did studio art ceramics in college. And I did nonprofit work right out of school, Baylor. And that had kind of run its course. I was homebrewing a lot. Another guy that was in the homebrew club with me wanted to open a place to kind of focus on craft stuff. And this is early 2000s. So the beginning of that big third wave of just explosion with American craft options. And we knew we were going to have to do a lot of education. We want to sell things to people that they don't understand. We weren't trying to sell these beers to people they've never heard of. And supporting Texas at the time, you know, we had Live Oak and we had St. Arnold's and a few Shiner and a few others, but all of that was just starting to blossom. But that was kind of nice too. Interacting with people, one way you can go about it is just like, look what people are spending their money on and then get it to them, right? If you want to get into that revenue stream somehow. But it was also really fun to realize, no, you can actually affect what people are craving and what people are interested in. If you'll do education, especially if you can do it in a very inviting way, like, hey, there's all this crazy stuff all over the world. Like, let's have a dinner. Let's have a little pairing. Let's sit down and walk through a style. And watching people, whiskey's not too different even today, watching people crave a level of information about what they consume and enjoy and spend their money on that they don't currently have. And I feel lucky that that's kind of stayed a part of our culture here, that we kind of enjoy bringing people along to the aspects of it that are exciting and really get us jazzed. That same, if I didn't work in this, I wouldn't have learned some of these things. Like, isn't this so cool? Like, look what this wood does. But being on the retail side was good. But I've also kind of always felt like, at the Dancing Bear and here, that in some ways, like, I'm my own customer. I don't chase and hunt down rare releases as much as I used to. They're also harder to get than they used to be, but distillery releases something cool, or a brewery's having a one day, you know, we drive down to wherever and stand in line all day to get two bottles of some stout or something. I don't do that as much as I used to, but I get that curiosity. There's a little bit of a collecting thing about it. Things you've never had that you've heard about. You're like, I got to get my hands on a bottle of whatever, you know, and then getting it and sharing it and making that communal. So that side of both the whiskey and beer market, it's always made a lot of sense to me. Just like, yeah, that feels like when I hear them talk about things they're looking for and get them excited, like, yeah, me too.
So Sauce Secrets is geared towards the startup Texas alcohol manufacturer, if it's all otherwise a business that's looking to get off the ground or a pre-business idea. You had a long history with the alcohol manufacturing process prior to actually opening up Balcones. What was that sort of first light bulb aha moment when it really clicked and the idea of professionally going into this came to light?
I had already quit my other job. I had already left the pub to do this full time, but there were two big ones in the first few years. In some ways, I'm not particularly ambitious in kind of business ways. I don't remember having a plan or a destination for where this would go other than the kind of day-to-day. Like, I want this to keep getting better. I want us to keep learning. I want us to keep perfecting the craft side of what we're doing. We're distillers. This is our trade. And for a long time, we were so small that that was fine. We didn't have to have a sales team. We didn't do any marketing. We were small enough that anything we did flew out the door. But really early, the only thing we'd released so far, I think, was the Blue Corn Whiskey. And being self-taught, we were a little curious for feedback. And you can get it, obviously, with consumers. But we sent a bottling off to the San Francisco
Spirits Competition.
And honestly, the intent was, I just kind of want some context. I want to know where this lands kind of on the landscape by people who know way more than me and have tasted way more things than me. And we got super surprised, but it came back with a double gold, and double is unanimous. Like, this was every judge's favorite. We were just like, oh, we were expecting to get an 84 and a bunch of good critical comments so we could get back to the tweaking the process. Granted, corn whiskey's not like the most populated category, but
it counts.
It was great, humbling, but also exciting. And then, you know, Southern Living showed up. I think multiple people are like calling and wanting to come by and do a little interview photo shoot thing. And you're like, wait, we haven't even been doing this like a year, year and a half at this point. But that was good. It was very encouraging to get that kind of affirmation, you know? And then the big one was a couple of years after that, when we've talked about this plenty in other formats, but the Best in Glass Awards, they don't still do it, but it was based out of the UK. And some of the folks that put that on had been pretty critical of small barrels and all these startup small craft distilleries. And so maybe someday they'll get good, but they're not very good yet kind of thing. But it was an invitational competition and it was blind. And so they went through their normal routine. And when they pulled the plastic bag off the winning bottle, it was our single malt that was maybe 14, 16 months old at the time. And they issued a big thing about, we've made all these comments about craft spirits and small barrels, and we might have to take it back because when we didn't know what we had in front of us, we actually really liked it. And then Clay Risen at the New York Times ran that story. It was a while later, maybe 6 months later. And that was the beginning of, like, we just couldn't keep up after that.
So how does that snowball effect and recognition, award-winning, and just attention to the brand, how does that contribute to expanding your product offerings? I mean, you guys have any number of different products. You have a delicious rum. What's the sort of the process behind different products?
I think we're pretty inquisitive and curious by nature, and also adding that to being self-taught. I mean, the rum specifically, I remember sitting there in the office at our old distillery, and a friend of ours had come by. He had been on a work trip, came back home with a bunch of rum, a bunch of Central American and Caribbean rums that he had picked up on this trip, and wanted to share them with us. So we're sitting there like all of these, like, oh, this is amazing, like all these crazy things. And literally turned around in the desk chair and was like, wait, we have a distillery. We should make some rum. We should just try our hand at it. Why not? But that story happened many times. The rye, some of the bourbon recipes that we don't even make anymore, it literally was just enjoying something and going, man, I wonder how they pulled this off. Like, I wonder what's different about getting this made from the things that we make. So we would just order some grain and make a batch or two just to try it out. So it's always been led by kind of interest. Another really cool side effect of that, that's not just unique to us, but I think a lot of Texas distilling, is there's been a lot of interesting cross-pollination from other traditions. We learned a lot running our stills to get higher ester rum that then we later changed how we ran our whiskeys because of that. Hmm. Or like Iron Root doing some cognac techniques. I think historically things used to be so siloed. And for most of the Texas folks. Most of us are pretty self-taught. Like almost nobody went and got trained anywhere other than like switching ideas with each other and asking for advice and stuff. So we all kind of learned things along the way that were just like, oh, that's really cool. They do that over there. Like, why don't they do that with whiskey? And like, well, we're going to. And turns out sometimes some of those ideas did some really cool stuff that if we had known more, maybe we wouldn't have thought to try, or we wouldn't have asked some of those questions.
So you guys launched in 2008. You were a part of a small, nascent, but growing Texas whiskey manufacturing industry. Fast forward 16 years, and obviously COVID was a wild card, but that population of that industry has gone up just exponentially. We have friends and clients at Vela Wood that really struggle with those early decisions about getting off the ground, in particular the grain to glass decision, which there is such a heavy lift to actually get up and going with the manufacturing capacity. You have any thoughts on what's the best approach for somebody looking to get off the ground? And even if it's not a one size fits all, but a transitional approach spread out over time, what do you think?
Yeah, it's tough. It was wide open territory when we got started, you know, when us and the Garrisons got going, nobody was doing it. So the competition was out of state. The uphill climb was just telling people that whiskey's made in Texas at all. For Dan and them, it was convincing people that bourbon didn't have to be made in Kentucky. Or for us, it was single malt doesn't make it scotch. You know, like pretty elementary, basic.
And you didn't have to name yourself after a Civil War general or some hill in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. But so those early years was a lot of education. And once again, I think something that was true then that I still think is true now is that most people would like to know more about things they're enjoying. It objectively enhances the experience to have just a little more information, you know? If you're a wine drinker and you're like, I think I kind of like drier. And you just like whatever the next tier of knowledge is about varietals or barreling, that then you're making better decisions. And so like my wine experience is more successful than it used to be because I know what to ask for. I know a family of roughly in this range, or I can tell somebody, oh, I really dig Zinfandels. And they go, oh, well, you'll like this, whatever. So there's still a very palpable need to kind of not talk at, but kind of invite drinkers into process. Some of these little nerdy details that really make all the difference in the world. And at the same time, it can be a little bit like cooking, you know, where if you're doing your job well, it can kind of not be noticed. If you do a bad job, it can be very apparent.
It's the same with practicing law.
Yeah, practicing law. Yeah, you're supposed to be good. I'm assuming you know what you're doing. The shelf's crowded. I think on-premise is some of the laws that have changed in the last 10 years to allow bottle sales and drinks on site. Huge difference.
Sure.
You don't have to go and try to jump straight into being like a 10,000 case brand. But there's also some stuff about making whiskey that just can't be avoided business-wise. Like the equipment is expensive and I'm not going to make it like beer. I'm not going to make it today and sell it in 6 weeks and get my money back.
Sure.
Just a lot of CapEx and a lot of waiting. Your return is years out. And what a question mark that is. What's the market going to be doing in 4 to 6 years? Like, who knows? It's sketchy, but I wouldn't discourage anybody from doing it. I think having unrealistic expectations or knowing pretty clearly what your vision is and then building your setup to arrive at that place is crucial. Even in beer world, I know people that started breweries, no intent to have a brew pub, public facing part. We're just going to do distribution, keg everything, no bottles, cans, whatever. And then something like COVID happens, then
devastating.
And now you have way more capacity than you needed. You didn't invest at the site. And so now you're trying to kind of like sort of beautify it because people want to come with their kids and dogs and hang out on Saturdays, you know, outside. And you didn't roof it, you know, whatever. And it's that pivot. We don't always know what's going to happen. But looking at the landscape and realizing you've got to figure out ways to stand out. And I think the infection of that is going to be just so word of mouth. It's going to be relational these days. There's so many things on the shelf. If my old college buddy, my brother-in-law, my sister, somebody goes, oh, I had this. It was really good. And the chances of me giving that a shot when there's 100 bottles I've never even seen before on the shelf, it makes a big difference.
Sure.
So giving people a good experience, if they're coming to a class, if you're doing a tasting at a whiskey show, if they're coming in your bar, I think makes all the difference in the world. And I think sharing expertise, which whiskey didn't used to do that well. It was all story and narrative and history. And it was nostalgic and it was romantic, but not a lot of conveying of information you can hold of how this gets made, what goes into it, what's unique about this place's process or their philosophy or whatever. So we love having people here the easiest way to convert people is to bring them to our house, show them around and spend some time.
So you brought up wine, talking about the wine experience, consumers becoming really interested in learning about the different terroirs, different types of wines, et cetera. One thing I've always found, well, it's sort of interesting about the wine experience and the consumer experience with it. When you see wine pairings, it's always the focus on the meal, on the food, right? Chicken pot pie, we recommend a Chablis with that, right?
Sure, yeah.
I think in the whiskey space, to the extent people want to enjoy food along with whiskey, it seems to be less the case. I've listened to one of your podcasts from the not too distant past where you talk about that kind of experience and how you can, you know, savor a whiskey that's complemented with the food experience, but that it's not the food experience that drives kind of the decision making.
Yeah, for sure. Food pairing with whiskey is somehow with beer and wine is a little bit easier. I think just because of the proof, spirits can be so strong that the idea of throwing a whiskey in with like a seafood dish or a salad, it's difficult. It's difficult to pull that off.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, but I think it lends itself to reverse engineering that a little bit. And you can kind of go two different routes. You can have things that are so complementary and obvious that like they're both lifted, or you can contrast things and then things show up in the dish and in the whiskey that you didn't notice before, but because they're so different now, it's like, oh, wait. It's like our smoked whiskey, for example, Brimstone, would often end up with dessert courses, even though people would think, oh, throw it in with like a steak or brisket or something, right? Because it's smoked and it's big and woody. But then we found over the years that using that one as a contrast was actually more fun than using it as a compliment. So using that with like an early seafood or a late dessert, you got a creme brulee and a smoked whiskey. It's like, oh man, there's so many cool things. This is creamy and this is kind of cutting. And
you got to try that.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to go. With food pairing, I think the proportions make a big difference to me. So to have a dram and like a bite or two of something, as opposed to here's ounce and a half of something while you're going to eat this massive plate with four or five different things on it. You can kind of isolate it a little bit. And I think simple's better too. And if you could just find a nice cured meat or a cheese or just something simple that's not overdone, that somehow the synergy between them, they both kind of get to be more than either one are by themselves. I think that's a worthy goal.
So the podcast is called Sauce Secrets. Let's talk a little bit more about the sauce. You guys have some of the most interesting, if not the most interesting stuff in the state. You walked through, I don't even want to call it trial and error, because it's just an iterative process of making a product more interesting and neater. Is there an alternate way to think about just making a product that's sort of textbook, and what would be the strengths or errors of doing something like that as opposed to the trial and error?
I think it's good to know what people have done before. It can be very easy to waste a bunch of time trying some things just to come to the conclusion that people figured out 100 years ago. But it's a fine line, because if you know too much and you get too beholden to what the precedents are, I know for us, there's a ton of things we never would have done if we had known more. I've had a lot of musician friends over the years, and it's somewhat predictable that people with a ton of training often aren't very creative. And then friends that are real creative, sometimes their technical skills are a little lacking, but they're just all over, like, can't be bothered. I'm not going to sit down and practice chords 5 hours a day. Are you kidding me? I'm writing songs. I got stuff I want to do here. So I think finding that balance is good. But also in the early years, I was talking to people, now retired master distillers of Kentucky and guys in Scotland. And there were so many unknowns about what doing this in Texas was going to look like, that it started helping us separate some known quantities and some things we weren't sure about, to have people like that go, oh yeah, yeah, that's going to be different. I don't know. You're just gonna have to try a few things. Okay, good. That's what we thought. And then also us going, hey, I was thinking about this or this, and then going like, oh no, no, no. We tried that 50 years ago. And like, if you do this, it's going to do this. I'm like, okay, cool. Another kind of confirmation moment of, we've got some things that seem like question marks. Are they question marks? And just to have Hall of Famers be like, yep, yeah, that's a question mark. You have to figure that one out. And maybe even some good suggestions on ways to try a few different things to see what it does. But I think if anything, the wide open landscape of not having a lot of Texas history with whiskey right in front of us, not coming into a market that's already flourishing with all its tradition and all of that inertia, was really liberating. At the same time, it was terrifying. But in hindsight, I'm so grateful that that was the case. If people could have answered all of our questions, I don't think we would have landed on a lot of the way we make things. And I think your past experience matters too. Like even coming from beer, like there's some things about how distillers almost unquestioningly run their fermentations that as a brewer, I was appalled. Why would I ferment so hot that it's like right on the edge of killing the yeast? The only reason to do that would be to go fast, not to necessarily create the best flavors and aromas. And we don't ferment completely like beer, but we've ended up somewhere in between because that just seemed ludicrous. Anyway, things like that, that I think people having the wisdom to bring even relevant experience from other fields, don't hesitate. Even if it's used to teach poetry, I don't care, whatever your background is, like bring that, augment what you're doing. It's a pretty organic and natural way to do whiskey in a way, make it, talk about it, market it, all of that in a way that probably no one else is doing. If you're willing to bring all of who you are to the table to enrich the experience for yourself and others.
So if you're looking to get into manufacturing here in Texas, and specifically whiskey, it's a different part of the world than Indiana or Kentucky or you name it. What are a couple specific items about manufacturing here that are simply something you can't avoid and need to at least be considered?
The grain situation's better. Years ago, I would have said getting Texas grain, specific kinds of grain, specific barley more so than corn and wheat is tricky. If you're committed to doing Texas-only grain, you're going to have some volatile, weird years where crops just don't do good. It's happened plenty of times where, well, we're not making as much rye as we thought this year or whatever. The most obvious thing is just the climate. For people that sure. haven't done this before and don't have a ton of experience with aging and blending, the one thing Texas will do extremely easily is extract oak from the barrel and figuring out just how to dance with that. We don't climate control. I'm not philosophically that interested in pretending we're not where we are. We are where sure. we are. But figuring out what you can do just to get back from the barrels, it's kind of a feedback loop. Taking some ingredients and a process, and then I'm handing it over, and then you're going to hold on to it for a few years, and then you're going to give it back to me. And if I don't like what I'm getting back, just asking all the good questions about how can I give you a different input so that what I receive back from you in a few years is more balanced or nuanced or just more to my liking. We love fruit here. We're always trying to figure out how to get the acid right and different kinds of acid, more complex fruit character. And so what do I need to give the Texas climate so that that's what it'll give me back? Which, you know, you said iterative earlier, but it does kind of just feel like this ongoing, cyclical, very seasonal. You receive something back, you learn from it, you do something different, you learn from it, just kind of keep going. A lot of times in house, we kind of talk about it. It feels like a conversation, you know, pitch you something, you throw it back, throw something back. Let's keep talking until we're both feeling pretty good about how this is going.
So you're right. The climate here is probably as big of a factor as anything. Mm-hmm. Y'all's facility here is what, 4 or 5 stories tall?
It's 4 stories on this side. It's just single story on that side. But
so how much of a difference is there between the barrels that are stored up on the top floor versus right on the second floor?
Definitely.
And even within different rickets, is there a big
difference? Oh, yeah, for sure. We have 2 more warehouses that are outside of city limits, and they're built very different than our brick building here. We don't have barrels on the first and second floor here anymore, but when we did, yeah, first, second, third, fourth, all very different. And they were 3 high. So even on a given floor, the bottom barrel versus the top barrel are radically different. And we definitely did some climate experiments over the years and some testing and have locations where we like different things to be. And sometimes things get moved. We're checking barrels after a few years. And if we like where they're going or like this one's going to be problematic, we might move it to a place that's going to soften the impact of certain parts of the barrel maturation and things like that. But it's another character in the story is location and the building.
So on Sauce Secrets, we always wrap up each episode with the same question. So let me ask you sort of the grand finale. What's an issue for the Texas distillery industry that nobody's talking about yet?
Honestly, I think probably the biggest one that I don't know anyone is talking about that I know we worry about internally is water table stuff, honestly. I know farmers are talking about it. What's Texas going to be like in 5 to 10 years? And what's our water situation going to be? Because it's gone down. It's going down. And whether it's a sustainability approach on how we do things internally and figuring out ways to reuse water, if it's lower input farming methods that we can get grain in and usable high quality grain that requires less water inputs, if it's varieties that are drought resistant. I mean, I don't know. We've done a little bit on the barley side is pretty new for Texas. And most of that stuff's like heat and drought resistant on purpose. And we are having some folks right now attempting to do some like no-till stuff and non-irrigated and all kinds of things just in case. Even the drought-resistant barley strains we've worked with here, which seemed very specific to Texas, you know, 8 years ago when we started working on some of those projects, that now I get calls from places that are warmer than they used to be. And someone in Florida, someone in Georgia is going, hey, which one of those worked out best? Because in the last 4 years, the stuff we normally grow isn't working. And I think the blending and maturation stuff is going to affect more people too. The climates are going to get extreme in places that have been just a little bit hotter even. It's going to make a difference. And people call me all the time. It's like, we're getting a lot more wood extraction than we used to. I need help. This used to be easy. And like now there's some blending tricks that maybe having somebody point us in the right direction would be helpful. It doesn't keep me up at night. And if we have major crop and water problems, I think the effect on the alcohol industry is probably going to be the last thing most regular folks are thinking about if food and things skyrocket. But I think being smart, because it shouldn't sneak up on us. If that's going to be a problem, then let's spend the time between here and now getting ready and mitigating it, as opposed to waking up one day and there's all kinds of agricultural issues.
So I read a quote from a fairly recent interview that you had that I'd like to share. We're aware of a sense of responsibility. Our whiskey is toasted when babies are born, at weddings, and at wakes. There is somebody I will never meet that experiences Balcones. People are inviting us into their homes via the whiskey. It feels like stewardship, and we get to nurture it. It's really poignant. Jared Hempstead, thanks so much for joining us on Sauce Secrets.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.